This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for June 2015. I'm Don Scher, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Lindsay Garbutt, assistant editor for the magazine. On the podcast, we listen to a few poems from the current issue. This month, we're going to hear from Erica L. Sanchez.
Possum Face carries a bucket of heads and spills them like marbles.
Carl Phillips.
Mortality seemed an ignorable wilderness.
And then we're going to talk about John Wieners with Michael Seth Stewart.
He didn't really care much about making a name for himself. He was really suspicious of fame.
We're joined by Christina Pugh, the consulting editor for the magazine. And once again, we've asked her to pick a poem from the issue to read for us. And she chose Every Job Has a First Day by Rebecca Gale Howell. So, Christina, tell us why this poem appeals to you.
Well, I liked the economy quite a lot in this poem. I loved the dialogue interaction between this poetic speaker and a guy named Slade who's pulling minnows out of a river.
There are all kinds of jobs in the world.
Indeed.
Here's Every Job Has a First Day by Rebecca Gale Howell.
Slade was pulling minnows out of the dry river the day we met. Puddles, more or less, was what was left. But what could Liv wanted to and tried, treading narrow circles, a glide of brittle fins. He wore those rubber boots, though the sun was an anvil and very little wet. He smiled, I remember that, his nickel smile right at me, his fingers letting fall the small fish muscles into a bag filled with yellow tap. I didn't ask his name or what it was he thought he was doing, but we talked. I listened as he taught me to relax the hand just enough. They can smell, he said, the oils our pores release when we tense to catch. You have to believe it, he said. You don't mean any harm. Unexpected ending.
Yeah.
I love what it's doing, just thinking about this whole question of belief, right? Mm-hmm. What does it mean to believe something and then express it in your skin, you know?
Yeah, and I love the sort of ambiguity in that ending. You have to believe you don't mean it any harm. That doesn't mean that you necessarily don't mm-hmm. mean it any harm.
Exactly.
But it doesn't mean that you don't.
Well, mean and harm rhymes, and there's a weird relationship between, what you mean and what you harm. But the thing that attracted me to the poem when I first saw it was really the very deft combination of what sounds like ordinary speech and extraordinary imaging, as you would find in a poem. So that Slade was pulling minnows out of the dry river the day we met sounds very conversational. But then when she's describing the rubber boots and says, though the sun was an anvil and very little wet, that's when it soars into a kind of poetry. So her modulation between the colloquial stuff that sets you right in this scene and the diction and the images she comes up with to push that into a whole different world for us is what I admired about this.
Yeah. The other thing that drew me to this, one of my favorite poems ever is Elizabeth Bishop's At the Fish Houses.
Mm-hmm.
And in that poem, too, there is a dialogue between a fisherman and a poetic speaker. But that poem is just so gloriously gorgeous in all the places that it goes. It's a much longer poem than this. I like the way this poem has the economy of 14 lines as if it's a sonnet, thinking through not only this narrative, but getting us to think about it as something like a sonnet with a turn. Mm-hmm. You have to believe it, he said. You don't mean any harm in the way that you guys were just talking about.
Well,
that.
And the turn, if that's what it is here, is really fascinating, that piece of information, because you have to love a poem that teaches you something you didn't know. I'm not much of a fisherman, but, they can smell, he said, the oils our pores release when we tense to catch. Or even just, the idea of the nuance of being taught to relax the hand just enough. Again, most poets would just go for the gesture and the bluntness of something, but the nuance, it sort of backs off of things at the same time as it advances them.
Mm.
So the turn at the end of the poem is the weirdness of what you have to do to make a catch, really,
yes, yeah.
And you're left with that. So it's quite wonderfully constructed. This is Erica L. Sanchez's first appearance in the magazine. She's a Fulbright scholar and a Cantamundo fellow who lives here in Chicago.
Sanchez's parents emigrated to the U.S. in 1979 from the state of Durango in northern Mexico. In recent years, the town her parents lived in has been afflicted by drug violence. She didn't want to name the town because her grandmother still lives there.
You know, outside of my grandma's house, people have shot at each other. They've blown up houses. One of the mayors was decapitated, etc. So it's something that really haunts me.
Sanchez writes a lot about violence, and the poem we're going to hear is part of a series about the drug cartels.
Reading all these accounts of these drug traffickers and the violence that they've inflicted on communities and particularly on women, it really troubles me.
Here's Erica L. Sanchez reading Narco.
Narco. Highway of death, the indifference of snakes. Sky is ripe and everywhere. The colors are breaking. ¿Quién es el jefe más jefe? In the filmy stillness, Possum Face carries a bucket of heads and spills them like marbles. La hierba, el polvo, las piedras. Que traguen fierro los cabrones. Yo soy el más chingón de Pisaflores. Rompe madres, gazing at mountains, the color of elephant skin. Pulls a woman from a bus and onto the thorns and dirt. White hiss of heat. Hummingbirds. Milkweed. A pack of spotted horses look to the foaming moon. May God bless you all and lead you toward righteousness. Under the final gash of light, Rompemadres wipes the sweat from his eyes and ties her panties to a creosote bush. A colony of vultures waiting for its tribute.
Don is a translator from Spanish. Do you want to tell us what those Spanish words mean,
well,
roughly?
Well, no, I mean, you know, you can figure it out. There's like the stuff that's growing there, the dust, the rocks.
La hierba, el polvo, las piedras.
I mean, in other words, the highway of death is not a figure of speech. It's literally a road through a landscape with snakes and sky and brutal sunshine and the bucket of heads is being spilled out there, which reminds me of Carolyn Forche's famous poem about the colonel. I mean, this is a terrifying landscape.
¿Quién es el jefe más jefe?
Who's the big guy in charge? So it's all about this violent kind of power. And the end of the poem is the kind of violence that we know happens constantly.
Rompemadres wipes the sweat from his eyes and ties her panties to a creosote bush.
It's not sort of a poem as a literary exercise, you know, and it's not an abstraction.
A colony of vultures waiting for its tribute.
Who's in charge around here in the end? The vultures.
Yeah, I think that's really important what you're saying about just the indifference, right? I mean, indifference is in the first line. Highway of death, the indifference of snakes. It seems as if the only part of the natural world that's not indifferent is the colony of vultures who are waiting, you know, with expectation and rapaciousness for that flesh. It's doing this very effective job, I think. And even the way it uses sentence fragments to do that.
White hiss of heat, hummingbirds, milkweed.
It becomes very visual. You get the strong feeling there's just no one in charge, as it were, right, to change this.
Yeah, and you can hear the hiss of heat. I mean, one thing she's so deft with here is the sounds, the white hiss of heat, hummingbirds, milkweed, a pack of spotted horses. In the beginning, the indifference of snakes, that hisses a little bit, and even the Fs in the word indifference sort of curve around ominously. At the end, the vultures waiting, you know, where you have the V and the W that are wing-like. I mean, she really has woven all of this stuff together, and there's not a wasted word here.
And even the people mentioned kind of blend into this landscape. The fact that the first person is called Possum Face makes them this sort of animal being also. The other thing that struck me about the poem was the use of words like foaming moon and the sweat in the end there. It's this kind of grimy, bodily, visual, but also like sensual aspect of the poem that is really striking to me, especially with those last lines of tying her panties to the creosote bush. You can see and you can smell this poem.
A Carl Phillips' first book of poems came out in 1992. That book and the many that followed have been celebrated for their musical and associative qualities.
This is his first appearance in poetry, and we're happy to have two of his poems in the June issue. The one we're going to hear is a dog poem. At least it starts out as a dog poem and then opens up into a lyrical meditation.
The dog in the poem is called Sovereignty. When we asked Carl Phillips for an introductory comment, the only thing he wanted to say is that he does, in fact, have a dog.
I will say the dog's name is not really Sovereignty the way it is in the poem. He's really named Ben.
Here's Carl Phillips reading Musculature.
The last dog I owned, or more humanely put, so I'm told, that I used to live with, she'd follow me everywhere. She died eventually. I put her down's more the truth. It is the truth. And now this dog, that I mostly call Sovereignty, both for how sovereignty, like fascination, can be overrated, and for how long it's taken me just to half understand that. Pretty much my whole life. Mortality seemed an ignorable wilderness, like any other. The past seemed what, occasionally, it still does, a version of luck, when luck, as if inevitably, gets stripped away. What hope, otherwise, for suffering? When did honesty become so hard to step into and stay inside of? I'm not saying forever. I could last a fair time on a small while. Sovereignty sleeps hard beside me. I pass my hands down the full length of him, like a loose command through a summer garden. Let those plants that can do so lean away on their stems toward the sun.
It's interesting to hear him read it. When you see this poem on the page, it looks a lot like prose. It looks very paragraphed, and it was great to hear him emphasize in a subtle way some of the line breaks.
Well, some of the stanzas kind of lean away from each other on their stems to steal
yes.
wording from the poem, which is very striking. And what it makes you realize is that the poem, after all, whose title is Musculature, has its own musculature, that if even hearing it especially or reading it on the page, what you see is the words sort of moving down, moving forward, pushing forward. There's sort of a lot of muscle in the diction here. The sort of moving hand that writes the poem is not really pausing. It's pushing forward until it reaches a kind of embodiment. You know, another way to look at it, although I think it's very forceful, is there is a kind of haltingness at the same time, which I think has to do with the kinds of self-questioning and doubts and mortality that infuses some of the thinking behind the poem.
The past seemed what, occasionally, it still does, a version of luck, when luck, as if inevitably, gets stripped away.
It's not only lovely, and it's not halting in a sort of hesitant way. It's halting in the way that we come to realize things, where you sort of, in increments, come by philosophical ways of looking and experiencing things.
Yeah, there's a push and pull in the poem that kind of makes all the different parts work together, like you said, like musculature. And I think one of those forces is that word sovereignty that suggests a sort of autonomy, but here nothing's really working alone. It's all working together. And then that final sentence,
let those plants that can do so lean away on their stems toward the sun.
It has a sort of royal tone to it, like let them eat cake, like let them do this if they can. But as he says, it's a loose command. He's not really trying to embody a sort of autonomous sovereignty. He's paired himself with this word in a way, or the dog.
Yeah, I like the way sovereignty is almost personified here. You know, it looks like it's going to become an allegory or something like that, where you would have people representing these different sorts of abstract concepts. And I love that it's a dog rather than a person here, and that it's a mantle that's imperfectly taken on, in a sense, intentionally so. This dog that I mostly call Sovereignty. And that, I think, really speaks to the points that both of you have just made about the way in which you can see the mind moving through these concepts and working out these elements of philosophical concern, also done through a proper name, in this case, Sovereignty. I think that's one of the real attractions of the poem.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, how how sovereign is sovereignty? I mean, the very first two lines of the poem really stick in my mind a lot because there is that question of the difference between what you own and what you live with.
The last dog I owned, or more humanely put, so I'm told, that I used to live with, she'd follow me everywhere.
People are always talking about taking ownership of things, and this poem calls that into question very, very deeply.
God love you, Dana, my lover, lost in the horde on this Friday night. 500 men are moving up and down from the bathroom to the bar. Remove this desire from the man I love, who has opened the savagery of the sea to me.
That's John Wieners reading the first part of A Poem for the Old Man from a recording up on Penn Sound, the great Poetry Audio Archive website. The date and location of the reading are unknown, but the editors of Penn Sound note that it's probably from Berkeley in July of 1965.
John Wieners was associated with beat poetry and the San Francisco Renaissance, but he spent most of his life in Boston and studied under Charles Olson at Black Mountain College. In the June issue, we're printing seven letters by Wieners from early in his career.
Michael Seth Stewart introduces the letters in the issue, and he joins us now by phone. Hi, Seth.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, clearly somebody who's gone to the trouble of editing John Wieners' letters and journals, which is a lot of work to do, means that you're a guy who's deeply interested in him and his work. So tell us what drew you to this guy. He's so strange and such an unusual poet. What drew you to John Wieners?
Yeah, I originally fell in love with him because someone presented me with a copy of the Hotel Wentley poems one night after class. I had come to graduate school to do 19th century literature, and then someone showed me this book, and I sat and I read it through, and then I read it through again and once more, and then I went to my advisor, Amiel, and said, okay, what's out there about John Wieners? Why haven't I read him before? I need to know more. Found out there wasn't much out there about him, and I told him basically the next morning that that was going to be my dissertation, and so I immediately fell in love hard.
So a couple of us, well, Christina and I spent a lot of time in Boston, and Wieners is a legend there. So why do you think it is that there has been so little written about him, and why have his poems been so hard to come by, really, for so long?
That's a good question, and it's one I'm still trying to figure out, honestly. He sort of fell through the cracks when it comes to the anthologies, other than Don Allen's New American Poetry, of course, which featured many of his poems. He really fell through the cracks of most others, and I feel like it's because he doesn't fit neatly into any of the groups. We like groups, and like you guys were saying before we started, he is associated with San Francisco, with the Beats, with Black Mountain. He always identified as a Boston poet, and so we have a hard time as a poetry culture dealing with a poet who doesn't fit neatly into any groups. Even as a Boston poet, I mean, he was living on the other side of Beacon Hill from all of these very celebrated poets like Robert Lowell and Anne Sexton and all of these other folks. But it might as well have been a different planet because his was the more working class, gay, lesbian scene. When he was hospitalized, it was in state hospitals, not McLean's, where Lowell and Sexton got to go gracefully insane, in Sexton's words. They weren't allowed to do the graceful part, Wieners and his friends. So I think there's a lot of different forces at play. You know, he didn't have money. He didn't really care much about making a name for himself. He was really suspicious of fame. When you read his letters where he talks about friends like Allen Ginsberg, he's really cautious regarding the kind of fame that they were after. And his hospitalizations also, you know, he was subjected to a lot of electroshock therapy, which really altered him. And so because of that, a lot of his critics, even sympathetic critics, wind up treating him in a way that I think is rather ableist by talking about his poetry as if it were just determined by his mental issues. I think it's a lot of different factors at work in keeping him out of the canon up till now.
Yeah, that's really interesting. In the letters, Charles Olson is clearly a huge, huge presence and huge influence for him, at least at that time. Can you talk a little bit about his importance to Wieners?
Oh, yeah. You know, he talks about Olson as being very much a father figure. You know, they became more peers towards the end of Olson's life. But he also, as soon as Wieners arrived at Black Mountain College, Olson took him very seriously as a poet, which mm-hmm. you can see in his letters to his old friend yeah. Robert Greene, his revelatory ecstasy at that, at being treated like a poet. And so that became probably the central relationship in Wiener's life, and one of the central relationships in Olson's life as well. It was quite reciprocal.
Another poet who looms large in these letters in this issue is James Schuyler. I love the letter. This is from 1957. He writes to Schuyler and he says, "Let me just say this off the top of my head, that you are going to have a tough time making it alone verse-wise there." I love that. And he goes on and he says, "People might like the feeling, quote, but why you write this way, knowing there is no other? They'll plague you because you self-doubt being weaned on Poetry Chicago."
Yeah. I was really pleased when that line made it into poetry. That really tickled me.
You know, we were talking about this earlier, but, you know, we did a selection of Creeley letters and the same thing. I mean, there was always this suspicion, still is to this day, of Poetry Magazine as being the establishment and all that stuff. And then, of course, Poetry goes on and publishes lots of work by these guys.
You know, for them at the time, Poetry Magazine, I think, did represent being part of that sort of poetry industrial complex, maybe. and so, you know, and which goes back to, I think, Wiener's ongoing suspicion of all institutions and organizations, especially if they had any sort of funding. Do you know what I mean? And this is why he was really drawn to Black Mountain, because it was so outside of the mainstream and so far, as Leanne Brown called it in a book she edited, far from the centers of ambition. And so they saw these institutions as being stultifying and publishing, you know, new critical verse that was very apolitical and very hermetic, and he was really pushing for something else, I think.
His letter to Schuyler also suggests that Wieners had a very particular notion of what poetry should be and what the role of the poet should be. What do you think that was, and do you think it changed at all throughout his life?
Oh, yeah. You know, I don't think it really did change, and I think it was very much determined by that early encounter with Charles Olson and with the projective poet idea, because he was adamant that the poetry be outward-facing in its stance, you know, addressing the world and addressing the real suffering in the world and trying to make the world a better place through poetry. And also within the verse itself, he was going for something that was getting away from the stultifying forms and measure. Like, I love that moment where he tells Schuyler that he liked his poem Joint, but was really disappointed that the lines were so regular, because those lines at right about, I think it was like 7 or 8 syllables per line, and Wieners was still just flushed with excitement from the Olson information of projective verse, and, you know, was really pounding that away with the zeal of a new convert, you know, and so, which leads to some pretty funny, you know, he's addressing all of these poets who are older and slightly more established than him, and he's addressing them as though he's been editing for decades. You know? Right. I need to change this. He writes a letter to Barbara Guest saying, you know, "I know that you can do better. This isn't it." You know, so Barbara Guest. And so it's just, it's kind of funny, this I don't want to call it arrogance. I think it's more just being a 23-year-old editor. He just was excited and sure of himself.
I still remember when Wieners died in 2002, there was sort of a flurry of panic, because I think people didn't really know where he was or what had happened with him, or, You know, you sort of had, in a way, a ghost-like presence, I think, at that time. And yet, as often happens, after his death, his work has sort of come back. Editions of his poems are coming out now, letters, journals, too, obviously. And why do you think it is that, in a way, at last, John Wiener's his time as a poet has come? What is resonating with people now, do you think?
I think part of it is the unironic sincerity of Wiener's is refreshing to us now. We're so steeped in irony and concept, which are two of my favorite things, don't get me wrong. But when Wiener's comes through, it really is that axe for the frozen sea, like Kafka and Anne Sexton talked about. You know, he has such a directness and combined with such a lyric intensity that you can't not be reached by it. You know, he reaches everyone. And I feel like we had kind of drifted away from some of those values in poetry, my personal sense anyway. And then in recent years, people have really been hungering for that kind of connection through poetry.
Thank you so much, Seth. Thank you for all your diligent work on this and helping us get them into print.
Thank you so much.
And thanks, too, to Christina Pugh for being with us on the podcast again. You can read the selection of John Wiener's letters and everything else you heard on this podcast in the June 2015 issue of Poetry Magazine or online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Lindsay Garbutt.
And I'm Don Scher. Thanks for listening.